continue from last time. We were talking about various forms of heter iska. I hope that at least part of this you can make a birkas hatera. The rest is simply mitzias and hamsoas, whatever. I'm not sure that that requires a birkas hatera. But first, what does require a birkas hatera? It's clear that an ordinary heter iska is not going to work in a mortgage. It's not going to work because it won't accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish. The whole lumdus of the heter iska, as we spoke about last time, was to create a situation in which there will be a chiv shua, a chiv in din, so that you can pay a fee in lieu of the shua, and the fee in lieu of the shua is whatever the financier, the neisen hamois, to use neutral phrases, wants as his profit out of this deal. But if there's no chiv shua in the first place, then he has no right to demand a fee, and there's no reason to pay him the money. It's not in lieu of a fee. It can only be ribis mucheris. It's either he's not entitled altogether, or it's gesel, or if he's getting it because you were so nice as to give him a loan earlier. So it's ribis mucheris at the very minimum, if not worse than that. And if it's stipulated that you're going to give him this ribis mucheris because ribis mucemis, I mean, you're not going to escape the problems. The problem in a purchase money mortgage, I meant not a bank mortgage, even the Jewish bank, although in practice there will also be a problem the way they arrange these things. Anybody who's ever been to the closing, I've never been there, but they tell me what goes on. I'll deal with the purchase money mortgage. Purchase money mortgage, it's clear what the problem is. Purchase money mortgage is a situation in which you have a middle-aged Jew who wants to live in Florida. He doesn't need his house in Flatbush anymore, so he wants to sell it. Only he doesn't want you to give him the money up front. If you give him the money up front, he'll put it in the bank, and he'll get 1% interest. That's not enough for him. He can't live on that. He wants you to take a mortgage. He's giving you the mortgage. The house is worth $500,000, whatever it's worth. And he doesn't want $500,000. He wants to get kach b'kach a month. You look at the amortization tables, a 25 or 30 year mortgage. He wants enough to be able to live in Florida ad mei v'esrim, so he figures out how much he needs. And he wants you, the Karen, plus what they would call ribis. He wants to have enough to live on in Florida with his Social Security. He'll manage to eke out a living. Now, there's a very simple etza for that if he would come and ask l'chatchila, and particularly the people who trust each other, the way is very simple, and they don't need mortgages, you don't need anything. I described what is a common purchase money mortgage, where the malvit doesn't want all the money up front. Sometimes he does, when the banks are paying more, if that ever happened, or if he's satisfied with what the banks are paying and even prefers it, because once upon a time, banks didn't default, only private people defaulted. That's a different situation, but if this is what the man wants, then there's a very simple etza here, and that is he should tell the lekeach up front, I want a certain amount for my property, and I want this amount, whether you pay me one or all at once, I'll happy, with all the interest that comes to, let's say, $1 million. You want to give me $1 million, I'll take it, and I'll put it in the bank for 1%. But I don't need it from you. I'll take either $1 million today, or you can pay me out $1 million over 25 or 30 years. But it's not one price for cash and another price if it's a purchase money mortgage. That's also. But if he says, I refuse to sell for less than $1 million, and Hadinima, he needs to be dollars to live. I can't. It's the only asset he has. This is how much I want. And you'll give me $1 million, I'll go to Florida. Otherwise, I stay here. How you pay me $1 million, I don't care. That's glatt kosher. You don't need a heter iska, yishtar mechira, that I'm buying the hat. That's worth $500,000, not $1 million, is irrelevant. The karka, there's no karkois. and the purchaser and the seller have agreed that this is the shavius. He's not going to sell for less. To him, it's the shoveli. He won't sell for anything. He can't live. It's a mitzvah. It's even true. He can't live on less, and he won't sell for less. If somebody will come and tell him the only way you can sell this is for cash, he'd say, "I'm sorry, I don't have enough to live on. I can't sell it for. I can't sell for $500,000." Kahai gavne is heter gomer. You're not talking about a mortgage. You're talking about a mechira, and he puts in the shtar that sure you can prepay if you want $1 million, but you have 30 years to pay out the $1 million, and that's loud childless, no problems whatsoever. But in the real world, that's not what people do for a variety of different reasons. I'm not going to enter into why people don't do this for whatever reasons. The first reason they don't do it is because nobody ever told them. It didn't occur to them that you can do it this way. But if you tell them that you can do it this way, in a lot of cases, it'll simply solve the problem. But the general problem with a purchase money mortgage, if you're trying to get a mortgage for the value of the house to be able to pay it out over a period of time, the problem is, how do you get interest? Because it says clearly the purchase price is $500,000. And the mortgage is carrying with it 5 or 6% interest. What's the interest for? So everybody knows all about this heteriske. What the nusach you're going to use, I don't know. But they'll say, well, I'll be heteriske, and we'll say, I'll be heteriske marama vigders, and we'll spell out chatsi milve, chatsi bekoden. Fine, wonderful. So you owe the money now is chatsi milve, chatsi bekoden, and the only problem is that in the case of a purchase money mortgage, he never gave me any money. There's no money. No money changes hands. So how could I possibly have lost his money? I come back later and I say, Rebid, the house went down in value. Or I didn't make any money on the house because instead of appreciating, it depreciated. So what do you want to share the revach with me? You and I both know that the house didn't go, the lomdus, let me speak about last time. The lomdus of a mortgage on a house is that the house is an investment, it goes up in value, and that the person who's extending the funds is entitled to be a shutif in the house and to share in the appreciation of the house. After all, he didn't get the money. Yes, he wants to be a chatsi pikodin in the house. But if he didn't give you the money or the opportunity to take the money and go invest it in the stock market or to make a killing some other way, he knows that you took the money didn't change hands and the money is in the house and the house didn't go up in value. So what kind of return is he entitled to? And even on the Karen, what you need to aid him, so bring you two brokers. They're easy to find. Everybody knows this. And certainly as far as the revach is concerned, everybody knows there's no revach. I know there's no revach. I'm the guy who gave you who's selling the house. How can I demand a shua? The shua is called the shua shov. And you're not going to swear anyway, so I'm not worried about the shua shov. What I'm worried about is the fee in lieu of the shua. If I can't demand the shua, then how can I demand a fee to pater you from the shua? It doesn't make sense. It's totally nonsensical. So the only reason you have to give me money, you don't have any amasla to give me, it's this fee in lieu of a shua. You're giving me the money because it's ribbis, no? One form or another. That kind of ribbis, it's tzarechet ribbis, because the house could have gone up maybe, I don't know. But tzarechet ribbis at least is going to be. So the shaila is, how can you avoid this? I purposely avoided the case of a bank. In theory, the bank gives you the money, a Jewish bank, gave you the money, and you could have run off to the stockbroker, invested it, and money. They want a shua from you that you didn't make money someplace else. In the real world, they don't give you the check. They give it. They don't trust you. They're afraid you'll invest in aqueduct or not in the stock market. So they don't give it to you. They give it to the meicher. And it's the same problem. They know very well what happened to the money, and that's where it was invested, and the real estate market went down because they foreclosed on so many properties they can't get rid of. They know better than anybody else what happened to the market. The standard heter iske just doesn't work in a mortgage. There's no way that it'll work in a mortgage. And a mortgage isn't the only case where it doesn't work. It doesn't work in broker's loans either. One of the stories that I had to come up with, I'll talk about that a little bit later, if I hope we'll get to it, was for a firm broker, not a customer's representative, this was one of the names you'd recognize. I'm a foursome. He's got margin accounts. and he's giving his clients money to buy stock, and it's got a loan agreement that carries with it interest. It suddenly occurred to him that he needs a heter iska. He didn't know that there's a problem with heter iska. He'll call up, he'll get a form, everything will be fine. So I was like, I was breaking my head. What kind of heter iska can I give this guy? He's lending him money to buy ABC stock. He never hands him the money. He uses the money himself to buy it on the exchange. And if the stock goes down, he's the first one who knows there was a loss. How can he share the profits of the appreciation, the value of the stock, when he knows that it went down? What kind of shvu is he claiming here? So for that, I'll talk about it later. I came up with an eitz that'll work for a mortgage also. Student loans, we don't even talk about. Nobody gives you any money in student loans. This is a separate problem. But in all cases where money doesn't exchange hands, let me start with the mortgage loans first. And it's nothing new. It's Alta Torah. It's published in Volume 1 of Contemporary Halachic Problems with a form. For this, I have a form too. But there are several ways to do this besides the one that I told you. The one that I told you is Heter Gomer. It's glatt kosher. It's not a loan. It's not a heter iska. It's garnished. It's a mechira. The conditions of a mechira. That's kosher even in Bnei Brak, I think. But if you want to do it in a standard way, there's several ways to do it, and let me explain how I think it could be done, and then how I suggest it be done in the real world, because how it could be done, nobody is going to want. Let's deal with this. I prefer it this way because I have a Kruma Cup. My Kruma Cup looks at things the way they really are, not the way that it's portrayed. When you buy a house and you make monthly payments, let us assume that the house costs $100,000, you're paying $1,000 a month, and it's for 1,000 months. Okay, fine. So you're paying $1,000 a month for 1,000 months is $100,000. You're paying, in effect, depreciation of the capital. You're amortizing the capital. You're giving part of the purchase price, of Kenyan, you're buying part of the house, and the rest is the interest on the loan. The guy who is selling you the house is selling it to you for, what I said, $100,000. The first month he is getting, when you give him $1,000, he's getting $999 as interest on $100,000, and the extra dollar is equity in the house, because now you have paid $1 out of the total purchase price. Let's think of, and that goes on. Next month, you're paying the same $1,000, only you're giving him $2 to buy more equity in the house, so you owe him less money, so you're paying less in the interest. That's how the tables work. The table is just the right number of dollars for the interest and the equity, so that they total the same amount at the end of the month, and you don't have to raise your cup to figure out every month how much interest I owe this guy, and how much can I afford to give him to get more equity. It's all one lump sum, and it makes a difference on the tax return, because on the tax return you can only deduct the interest on the mortgage. You can't deduct what goes to reduce the capital. So if anybody's got a house, every year he takes less and less off his income tax, because less and less is interest, even though the payments he's been making every month, every year, are exactly the same. He's paying the same amount of money, but he gets less of a tax deduction, because part of it is purchase of equity, and the rest is interest. In the real, and the person even speaks about, in lawyer's terms, of the equity he has in the house. What's the equity in the house? The value of the house above the mortgage, assuming that the house hasn't fluctuated in value. It was $500,000 when he bought it, $500,000 today, but he's paid off $100,000 of the principal. He's got $100,000 equity, right? Now, I don't think I'm total nar, but I think that if I look at the house, the same house, $1,000 payment, and we've got 100,000 bricks, what am I doing every month? Every month, I'm buying another brick in the house. The first month, I bought one brick. Second month, I bought two more bricks because I had more money to buy bricks with. So at the end of that month, I end up with three bricks in the house. Now, the rest, the other, 9,997 bricks belong to the guy who's trying to sell me the house. It's his house, his bricks. Isn't he entitled to rent? He's renting me those bricks. So I forget interest. I don't know anything about interest. We live in a world that didn't know about mortgages, and didn't know about interest, but knows about landlords and tenants and purchasers and sellers. In the real world, what am I doing? It's the truth. The truth is that every month I'm buying more bricks, and therefore it's only yosher I should pay less rent. The bricks I own, I don't have to pay rent for. I only have to pay rent for the bricks that I don't own. So for those, I owe rent. And the rent goes down every month. So Baruch Hashem, if you have dollars in my pocket, I can afford to buy a few more bricks. So the following month, I should pay even less rent. That's 2 and 2 is 4 to me. To me, that's a Dover portion. No, so I'll write such a, quote, heterisk. And again, I think it's kosher b'nei brak also. Instead of nusach of a mortgage loan, I write, here's a little table in the back. You know what? I didn't have to write the table. I went to a mortgage broker, and I got the table that he has. When he has headings, it says amortization of capital, and it says interest, and I cross out the top, and I say purchase of bricks and rent for the rest. And the first month, I'm paying gewaldig rent. The last month of the 30-year loan, I paid a garnish for rent, and the rest was to buy the last couple of hundred bricks that were left in the house. So I write this little nusach that says that each month I buy so many and so many bricks per month as in accordance with the affixed table, and the rest represents the rent for the bricks which I have not yet purchased. And everything is fine and loyal, and this, I think, has no shilas whatsoever. It's kosher, it's glad kosher, lechatchila. What's the problem with it?
Can you back out in the middle? How much? Because I don't want
to not back out. Don't be worried. Back out.
No, stop selling. Stop renting.
The owner of the house has entered into a binding leasehold. He can't back out. Mm-hmm. He has no choice. That's what a lease is. Now, Schirus is Kamemkadom. He's Seicher the Bayis, Masker the Bayis. So he can't back out. The problem is that the person who's living in the house can't afford to pay the rent. Paying rent, remember, and he can't afford to buy any more bricks. We call it defaulting on the mortgage. If what I described is what they agree to, then when you have to go, there should be in this house. And we're now dealing with good or good. We have to sell it and divide it in accordance with the proportionate share. That's, to me, that's fair. I have no problems with this. Because the way I arranged this, he bought X number of bricks. When you go to sell a house, he gets X over Y being the purchase price. He gets that share. It's only fair. Only the seller wants things that I'm not sure are yeshur for this kind of arrangement. He wants that if the house goes down in value, that he should get what it was worth at the time they entered into this business. He doesn't want to be stuck if the market drops, and therefore he's not going to want to buy this. That's the practice in the real world out there. Mele, if everybody is acting with yosher, and this is what they're doing, then my arrangement is perfectly valid. But if the guy somehow wants to be sure, I don't know why, because I want to avoid any shilas or ribs altogether, and what I'm proposing is perfectly fair and legitimate, but if he somehow wants to protect himself because he wants to make sure that he gets his $500,000 plus whatever else he wanted for rent over this period of time, but that ultimately he wants to be able to make sure that he gets $500,000, because then he won't be able to find the kainah for the rest at his price, for the rest of the bricks, I mean, at his price. So he won't want this. Okay, fine. Zolzai. So I come up with a second eitz. My second eitz is even simpler. It's less in conformity to reality. But, you know, sometimes this is derech arucha shehiketzara. The first one was arucha shehiketzara. The second is ketzara shearucha in a certain sense. But it also parallels other things that go on out there. If you look at the newspapers these days, the automobile companies are trying to push rental lease agreements for cars. You can basically forget about today's economy. But 5 years ago, I find a balabos, a gvir, who has a business. He gets a new car every 3 years. And that's in some circles. Not yeshiva shikars. We start talking after 10 years. We don't talk about the first 3 years. But people out there, they trade in their cars every 3 years. And the people out there don't pay cash for their cars. It'd be crazy to pay cash for cars. I can tell you a little. I mean, we're talking about gevirim. A portion of the people pay cash for cars, but the gevirim don't pay cash for cars. I'll tell you a little. The Gaya Ribis story. There's a woman. She's a scientist. I didn't even tell you her name. She's an endocrinologist. She thinks that she has a cure for infertility in the Ashkenazi community. She thinks it's a hormone deficiency, and she thinks she can synthesize the hormones. And she's not the fly by night. I mean, she's the chairman of a department of endocrinology in a major New York hospital. She knows me from whatever. She comes and she asks me, she wants to approach Paul Reichman in the good days when he had a lot of money. It's an Ashkenazi jury, and she has a cure for infertility. She wants $1 million from him. Can she use my name? So I tell her, I never met Paul Reichman. I don't know if Paul Reichman will know the name. For all I know, it's the Kendall Schattenech, if he knows the name. But you want to, Gesundheit. Fine. A couple of weeks later, I get a phone call from Paul Reichman. He wants to know, who is this woman, and is she for real? So I told her, look, the woman, I can tell you her credentials. I'm not a chemist, I'm not a biologist, I'm not even a doctor. That I sit together on the governor's council, so I can tell you that she's got credentials. She claims that she's onto something. I'm sure it's not snake oil. Whether it'll work, it won't work, I'm not in a position to be her oriv. But if she says that she needs a grant for research, it's research, and she's not, it's not fly by night. So he says, when it's all over, he says he'll consider giving her the money. Does she think I'm a fool? She wants $1 million so that in her grant proposal, in those days, she was going to get 10%. You think if I got only 10% from my money, I could afford to give her $1 million? I'll give her $100,000 a year if I give her any money, but I'm certainly not going to give her $1 million up front. That doesn't make sense. I can make more than $100,000. Paul Reichman, I didn't ask whether he buys a car or leases a car. I assure you, Paul Reichman leases cars and doesn't buy cars because he can make more than the interest on the lease. He can invest it in canary Doc or whether he makes or he doesn't make, but the point is to make a lot more than this. Okay, that's what the car dealers offer you, a choice. Either you buy it or you lease it for X number of years. How do you buy it? So you pay $30,000 if you're buying a cheap car. Otherwise, you pay $100,000 or chesvos. Or how do you lease the car? You lease the car by figuring that it's a 3-year lease. So you divide $30,000 by 3 years, and you pay $10,000 a year, but you don't pay quite $10,000 a year. Because when it's all over, the dealer takes it back and he sells it for what, $5,000 to the schnorrers who buy it afterwards. So he figures it for $25,000. It's the same thing. If this person bought it and paid $30,000 up front, at the end of 3 years, the car is worth $5,000. So he's paying $25,000 to use the car for 3 years. So he has a choice. Either call it interest on the loan, go to the bank and get a car loan of $30,000 and pay the interest on it, or lease the car and you have the quote, the interest, close quote, factored into the purchase price, because if he's going to re-enter into a lease, it's not going to be for $30,000 for 3 years. It's going to be $30,000 at 5 or 6% interest for 3 years, and it'll amortize interest. We'll make level payments just like with a mortgage. Now, how does Paul Reichman decide which he's going to do? This is Elbezach. Yeah, he decides that he's got a cheap loan from the car company, unless he can borrow it for less money someplace else for a lower interest. That's his business, he and his accountant. But he's got another cheshbon. His cheshbon is different. I guarantee you that he leases and doesn't buy, for a very simple reason. If he buys the car and uses it for business, he has to amortize it. I don't know what it is now, 7 years, 8 years. If he leases it, he writes off the whole business as a business expense. The capital, the interest, everything. It's a total business expense as far as he's concerned. So what is driving all of this? What's driving all of this is the taxes, the shmer. But in the real world, what's happening? Who owns this car until the end of the lease period? The bank owns it if you take out the loan to buy it. And if you lease it from the automobile dealer, so the dealer owns it. Either way, you don't own the car. And if you're paying off the loan, yes, you get a little bit of equity along the way. That's exactly what this is. This is what I'm telling to do with the the loan agreement business with the mortgage. Now, what do I mean? This is the second way. The second way is really very simple. The company that leases you the car for 3 years with an option to buy at the end of the lease. He'll give it to you for the same amount that he'll sell to somebody else. He may even give it to you for a little bit less because he doesn't have the transaction cost, doesn't have to advertise, doesn't have the overhead. It's easier for him to sell it to you. Nope. Instead of having a mortgage agreement, I have a leasehold for 30 years. And guess what? I want as the rent for 30 years the same thing that the mortgage broker wants for the twin to this house across the street for a sale for 30 years. Only what am I giving you in the Nadin? At the end of the 30-year period, the title will transfer for a sum of $1. That's another way of doing exactly the same thing. You enter into a leasehold for that period of time, and if you keep up the payments for the full, the maker is fully protected, you keep up the payments for the full 30-year period, you have the option of buying it for a single dollar. I can even be nice to you if I want to, and you won't buy it otherwise, and that is that if at any time during the 30-year period the both of us agree to sell it, I will get X number of dollars, which is the purchase price, and the rest you will keep. What are you keeping? You're keeping your equity. The amount that you paid me that otherwise would have been a reduction of the purchase price, because she did get equity. And this is the deal between us. The deal between us is that if we'd ever realized a profit on the real estate during this period, that we'd share the proceeds. That's another way of dealing with this. And you don't have problems of a heteriska. You don't need a heteriska. It's called a leasehold. Leasehold agreement with an option to purchase for a nominal sum at the end. That's the one that I drafted. It's there. It's available. It's in the Rishus HaRabim. No royalties. You can use it anytime you want. Anybody can use it. And the beauty is you can use the same amortization tables to figure out how much equity is here, so that at any point, if you default, you know how much you're entitled to. Good. Those are the two ways. This doesn't solve the student loan problem or the broker's margin problem. There's another way of dealing with this. Third kind of heteriska, and the third kind works for everything. One size fits all. And the basic problem I'm trying to cure is the fact that there's no room for a shvu, because everybody knows that no money changed hands and there was no profit. And that is for the person who's getting the money to enter into an agreement to set aside a certain amount of money equal to the amount that is now not changing hands, and to invest it in fact, to agree to invest double that amount, the whole Esek Toiv, Chatzi Milva, Chatzi Pekodin, that every Esek Toiv, half of it is your money and half of it is my money. Or let me rephrase it. I want to buy a house for $500,000 or better. I want to buy stocks with a margin account and I margin $10,000. Nobody opens a margin account if that's the only $10,000 he has. The broker is not going to give you credit. He gives you $10,000 as a margin loan if you have other investments. So I've agreed on behalf of the broker that I will take another $20,000 and I will invest it in some other way. It's not his business how. He doesn't care. He's relying on my business judgment. He only advises me on stocks. All my other investments, that I get other people to advise me. But he wants to be a shutuf in everything. Just like I diversify, he also wants to diversify. He doesn't want to be only an ABC stock that he's lending me money to buy. He wants to be in Canary Wharf. He wants to be in everything else that I invest in. So we are now equal partners b'chol esek toiv. The market went down. It doesn't mean the real estate market had to go down. He doesn't know what else I did with this money. Everything could have gone up. And if I am an equal shutif b'chol esek toiv, then at kol esek toiv I'm going to invest tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. The lotion has to be this way, that I have agreed that I will now go out and take twice the amount that you lent me for the margin account or for the house, and I will invest it equally for you and for me. Then when I am investing, the investment is on behalf of both of us, so that I am really chatzim milva chatzim pikot. Whatever I was koine on behalf of two people, on behalf of you and on behalf of me. That's how this one works. Mameli's entitled to the shvuah, and he wants edim, nemonim, and sharing that I lost the keren, that I happened not to have any money and didn't invest it. No, so I lied to him. Or in the imibidibura, I don't know chusar amona. I don't know what I am, but I was not chas v'sholom aloy v'beribis. I'm not here, and he doesn't know whether I have money. And he doesn't want to look too far. It's better for him if he doesn't look too far. This is the simplest way to avoid it, but this is a heterisk. This is the others. I managed to avoid a heterisk altogether. This way, we don't have a heterisk. Now, there are a lot of neschois floating around out there. I haven't seen a single one that I understood. Either I don't understand them in halacha, or I don't understand them because they don't work legally. I mean, I don't understand what's going on here. One I was shown recently, in addition to all the other problems I had with it, and this, I don't know who drafted it. I don't want to know who drafted it. The nusach was, I don't know where he got the idea. Maybe he got it from me. I don't know. But he, instead of, you know, I've discovered that people are kind of bishinui. And the shinui is always a kilkel. Instead of obligating myself to invest X number of dollars, b'chol esek toiv, amakne you all of my investments, or 50% of all, and it was the nusach, that I'm conveying a half, I don't remember the words. If somebody wants to identify the document and say what it said, because it's fine as far as I'm concerned, but it said that he was conveying an interest in all of the investments that he has, equal to whatever the amount that was extended was, or double the amount of what was extended. And my problem is that all the sokim that this person possibly had to have been in a milva of one kind or another. He didn't have karka to be makna. Whoever's taking this loan certainly had no karka to be makna, and that's easy to demonstrate. So it had to be some type of what was probably a loan of one kind. A deposit in a bank account is also a loan. It's a milva to the bank. For that, you need ksivim mesira. You can't just I'm selling to you because of this piece of paper. I'm selling it to you. Where's the kinyan? And if it's not a kinyan, so it reduces itself to a halvoa, and a halvoa, I'm back again to an isaribis. It hasn't solved the problem. Sorry. Lechatkila, I don't know why I'm not allowed to do it if the other person tells me in advance that I don't really care if you do or you don't. But remember that if you don't, I'm going to demand a shvua that you didn't, and you're going to have to pay me a certain sum if you don't want to take the shvua. In effect, he's saying you're going to be a name of the Baruchah in one way or another, and since there's going to be this accord and satisfaction to get an upper limit in terms of the dividends I'm going to get out of this, I couldn't care less. What difference does it make to me? I'm allowing you the option of doing nothing and taking a shvu out of the kindness of my heart. No, I don't think he's a name of the Bury. Okay? Now, that's basically how I think the thing has to be structured. The problem is, I said before, that I haven't seen, of all the Niskois that I've seen, I haven't seen any that I understand. The Niskois, maybe I should make a collection of them. The standard nusach that people seem to be using out there, the lawyer or the broker or whoever it was has a rubber stamp in his drawer. He takes an ordinary loan agreement and he puts a stamp, al pi heterisk. First of all, I don't know what that means. I think I say this last time, I don't remember. Who's heterisk? You mean heterisk of Maram, heterisk of Chochmas Odom, heterisk of Bnei Brak? Baruch Hashem, I don't sit in the diaries, but you came to me, forget the Ribbish Eilis. Afterwards, there's a sichsuch between the Malv and the Leuva, and he comes with a piece of paper and says, I'll be heterisk, and they now want to know what are our obligations. I don't know what your obligations are. The words, I'll be heterisk, don't tell me enough. What kind of head? What's going on here? And Bidinehem, I have one case, it's Aronoff. Aronoff was clearly a case where whoever was negotiating all this for the parties took out a rubber stamp, set up Yeter Iske, and stamped it on a loan agreement, and the court gave summary judgment on the loan. And said, there's nothing to try. We don't need a trial to find out what a heterisk is, because it doesn't make any difference. Even if the heterisk is what you say it means, the same nusach says, in the here, there they even had a nusach beferish, that nothing in this document, which it's a standard Blumberg form, should be construed as a joint venture of a hule of a hule. So the judge points to this. It says that nothing else that could put you in this document means it should be construed as a joint venture. So even if the heter isk is what you people are telling me is a joint venture, it's not a joint venture. What difference does it make? It's totally worthless. But that takes us to the issue that Rabbi Willig touched on last time. I mentioned it in passing. Does it have to be enforceable b'dinehem? Here I don't know if it's enforceable b'dineinu, but naniach it will be enforceable b'dineinu. Does it have to be enforceable b'dineihem? This also is Alta Torah, and it's more recent. It's an article in Tradition, Heterisk in American Courts. It's within the last year in the traditions. Basically, the question is a broad one: is the heterisk enforceable in an American court? Just before I go any further, the answer is emphatically yes. A heterisk is enforceable in an American court. One caveat: you better have it drafted so that it makes sense. And also be careful that at the trial, the expert witnesses shouldn't contradict the heterisk. You read these cases, they're people, I don't know who they're getting for witnesses. They come into court and they talk, gibberish would be good, but gibberish I don't understand. Problem is, when he gets up on the witness stand and says it's a loan agreement, then I get to, then it's worse than gibberish. He's telling you, it's mavish steer, and they obey. And every head, with one exception, I'll tell you the exception in a moment, every case in which the court has thrown out the heter iske has been because it was improperly drafted as an Aronoff. The Nusach says, the Blumberg form says, it's not a joint venture. You wrote all the Eteriske. Why are you trying to confuse me here? Or you had witnesses who said, it's not a Eteriske. There was one crazy case. The witness says that it's a loan agreement and that you're not allowed to take interest. That's why we have these things. And we have these things because you're not allowed to take ribbis. Let's take ribbis. Okay, so the judge says, very good. What's his psak? His psak is pay the Karen and don't pay the interest. But one thing he gave him, that there's interest from the time of the entry of judgment to who knows what, because he hasn't heard any testimony saying the Jewish law says you're not allowed to take that. You're not allowed to take the interest of the loan. But the interest on the court's award, that he thinks is mutter in halacha. Now, ribis derech knas, not derech knas. He doesn't know the lumbus. There was no testimony. So that he was mechayiv. But if it's not a loan agreement, then you don't have to pay the interest. The one case that, and this goes back who knows how many years, the original case is Leibovicki versus Ravicki, two nice Italian names. The court said it was a partnership agreement. Very, very simple. It was a heter, it was a standard, it was a good heterisk, and the court recognizes a heterisk. All the other cases where the heterisk has been thrown out, it's been thrown out because either it didn't make sense, wasn't drafted properly, or because you had oral testimony contradicting what the thing said. So what do you want from the poor judge? You tell him it is a loan agreement. It's not a loan agreement. Make up your mind. What's going on here? The only case which the court threw it out is Edelkin versus some Fairmont funding company, Connecticut, 2008. It's the most recent case. It was a federal magistrate's court. Those aren't district courts. And he cited two cases as precedent and misread both cases. Sorry, he did. It was all done. The magistrate was not Moritz, but he threw it out. He said that it's